Hello, Ash here. Just a quick interruption to say that you can now buy catch-up passes to watch recordings from the first Digital Works conference. The recordings are available to watch back in full until August the 9th, 2024, and they cost just £75. You can buy passes on the Digital Works website at thedigital.works. Okay, back to your regularly scheduled programming. Hello, and welcome to the Digital Works podcast, a podcast about digital stuff in the cultural sector. My name's Ash, and today's episode is episode 9 of Bytes. Bytes is our regular short-form series where we look at three or four interesting things from the most recent edition of our Digital Works newsletter, and you can sign up for the newsletter on our website, which you can find at thedigital.works. Joining me today, and for all episodes in this series, is the person who puts the newsletter together, my colleague Katie. And today we'll be discussing things from the newsletter, which went out on Monday, the 15th of April, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes for this episode. So, Katie, the three or four, actually, things we are going to look at today are a new report from Deloitte looking at 2024 digital media trends, a blog from Aaron Cope at the SFO Museum about their experience joining the Fediverse, an article in Marketing Brew about the New York Times developing new metrics to measure attention, and I also want to hear your take on the AI project that you linked to, Synthetic Memories. I don't have a take on it because I can't get it to load on my computer. Maybe there's a lesson in there somewhere.
Okay.
So the first thing is this report, set of reports from Deloitte Insights looking at 2024 digital media trends. And you pulled one stat out in the newsletter, which is that 60% of Gen Zers prefer user-generated content over streaming services. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole load of other interesting observations from what I can see. There's things about the type of content that audiences more generally prefer. There's an interesting article looking at, as they term it, the untapped potential of fandom. There are questions about the business models that underpin streaming video services. There's a focus on women video game players and maybe whether the video game industry is leaving half the population underserved. But, you know, you've looked at this report. What are your takeaways from it? Which bits do you think are perhaps most interesting to the folks listening to this?
So I think there's a couple of things, and you've touched on them there. The first thing about 60% of Gen Z preferring user-generated content is interesting, more because they qualified that by the addition of the fact that it's because they don't have to spend time searching for what to watch. So the content is being delivered to them algorithmically on TikTok or whatever, which is, to me, quite shocking. There's a lot in that, isn't there? The fact that you would rather have somebody, not somebody, you'd rather have a platform learn what you like and then deliver you stuff rather than, oh gosh, having to actually make the effort to search for things. It probably speaks to how good, in inverted commas, these algorithms are getting at assessing what kind of content people like, especially things like TikTok, which obviously that's what it's known for. It also, though, from a content creator perspective, in terms of organizations and so on, is a sort of bit of a warning sign as well, isn't it? A reminder that, you know, now more than ever, you can't rely on people looking for your stuff. It's got to be good enough, and it's got to be targeted enough at a clear enough audience that it will find them. So that was one thing. And then the other thing is, again, that you mentioned is the fans. So the report picks up on the fact that for many people, being a fan is core to their identity. That's something, of course, that Kevin Kelly wrote about in his very seminal famous essay, 1,000 True Fans, which was originally written in 2008, and he did subsequently update it. So for those people who haven't read it, it's an article that talks about how you don't need to try and get the biggest audience possible. you really need to try and get just 1,000 people who are true fans of what you do. The figure 1,000 isn't a set in stone figure. It's more the sort of concept. And I was thinking about that when this report came out and they highlighted this kind of fandom increasing sort of trend for people being very passionate about certain things. And that made me think of organizations like the Tank Museum, who've managed to build a huge fan following on lots of platforms, but not least platforms like Patreon, where they're making something like £200,000 a year just from giving fans like exclusive type content. So yeah, I think there's some kind of good connections there.
Yeah, and I think the thing that came out when I looked through is that, and this is something we've talked about before, but it does feel like we are in this moment of change, and sort of the way that the internet on the whole has sort of worked, existed for the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years is undergoing a shift. And that is driven, as you say, by generational differences in how people are sort of finding and engaging with content, but also the way that these platforms are working and where people are finding value and finding success. So I think it is absolutely worth folks taking a read through what this report is saying, because it feels like there are medium and long-term strategic implications for how and where cultural organizations are going to be focusing time and investment in finding, building, and serving online audiences.
Yes, for sure.
Our next thing is a blog post from Aaron Cope at the SFO Museum titled Holding Hands with the Fediverse Activity Pub at SFO Museum. And it's talking about the experience that Aaron and colleagues at SFO Museum have had in joining the Fediverse. It's quite a long read. I think it's useful in that it explains what the Fediverse is, how it works, why SFO Museum were carrying out this experiment, a bit of historical context, and their experience existing on the platform. And the Fediverse is not a new idea, but it certainly has come to greater prominence with the, how should we describe them, changes that Twitter in particular has undergone over the last couple of years. And there was a bit of an exodus, is that the right word? Growth in a platform called Mastodon. And Mastodon exists in this sort of Fediverse decentralized model. So, Katie, maybe first, for folks who are new to this idea, what is the Fediverse? Oh God,
I knew you can ask me that. Okay. Okay.
And why is it perhaps interesting for cultural organizations to be thinking about, looking at, considering this model of existing online and this model of social media platforms?
Okay, so better minds than mine have explained the Fediverse. In the article that we're talking about, he links to another article which The Verge did, which is called The Fediverse Explained. Highly recommend reading that. In short, the Fediverse is a term that just refers to a set of decentralized services. What does that mean? And the example often given to describe decentralized services compared to centralized services is like something like email. So with email, I might use Gmail, you might use Outlook, but I can send you a message, you can send me one. With something like Facebook or Twitter, they're considered to be centralized because we have to both be on them to exchange messages. So the idea with the decentralized services and Fediverses, or no, it's not plural, the Fediverse, is that you are not tied to a sort of one place. And obviously from a tech platform's perspective and questions around the kind of, you know, all the stuff around the sort of ethics and the so on of these big tech platforms, the sort of promise in inverted commas of the Fediverse longer term is that we, so individuals and organizations, won't necessarily have to be tied to platforms. Instead, we'll be able to sort of share our content, our interactions. It will be more in our control. Yeah, that's sort of a, maybe not a brilliant explanation, but an explanation of what the Fediverse is. And the article, and this isn't a criticism, it's an observation, but it has that sort of vibe that sometimes museum type articles like this have, which is it's quite information dense. And it's quite, you know, unashamedly and quite rightly sort of geeky and techie about what they're trying to do. The reason I think it's interesting is because they are, as you said in that intro, they are exploring what this might mean. They're not saying this is going to be the answer to everything, this is going to change everything. It is an experiment. They reference an article that we have linked to before in Digital Works, which is about the BBC talking about doing this as well. And so really it's an experiment for them to see. I mean, they phrase it as, could this help us broaden our audiences, reach new audiences? And they also, I think the phrase he says, is this a way that we can share content with a diverse audience without having to enter into one or more Faustian bargains that the large centralized social media platforms increasingly demand? So it's kind of interesting in and of itself, I think, for that, in terms of trying to move away from, as they describe it, this kind of Faustian pact that we all have with these big platforms.
Yeah, and I think from an institutional perspective, it's useful to keep up with these types of conversations and to be aware of which organizations are maybe dipping their toe and to see how that experience goes. I think you're right. It is a, or maybe requires a more sort of technically literate approach than many of the sort of more, in inverted commas, mainstream social media platforms. You know, there's lots of descriptions of specific code that's been written and specific servers that have been set up and links to GitHub repositories and things like that, which may put some organizations off at this stage. But I would encourage people to keep tabs on the conversation, because it does feel, you know, we just said that we're in this sort of moment of tectonic plate shifting a little bit, and there could be a world in which in 3 to 5 years' time, things are more decentralized and more fragmented. And so therefore, understanding how these ecosystems work is a useful thing for people to be aware of.
For sure, because just one final point on it is that some people may have heard that Threads, which is owned by Meta, which own everything, basically, Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, you know, are decentralizing, are going into the Fediverse. I don't even know what the correct terminology is. And so if an organization of that size is considering these sorts of things, it is definitely something that is just worth keeping an eye on, for sure. Absolutely.
Our third thing is an article in Marketing Brew titled "For the New York Times, Attention Metrics Find New Applications." And it's talking ostensibly about a new partnership that the New York Times has entered into with Adelaide, which are a company that use signals like eye tracking data to gauge whether readers are paying attention to ads, which in and of itself is maybe not the most interesting thing to look at. But I do think it touches on a wider shift we're perhaps seeing. Earlier this year, The Guardian launched a new feature on their site where they rank articles by the most deeply read, which is very different from most viewed. And that's looking at engagement in a different way. Conversation I had on the podcast last year with George Montague from FT Strategies, we talked in that conversation about the new metrics that the Financial Times have developed to understand how online readers are engaging with different formats and different types of journalism. And it does feel like this conversation is a useful one for cultural organizations to remain engaged with, because increasingly cultural websites, cultural digital experiences are focused on engagement. And there is, it seems, a maturing of the conversation around how engagement is sort of understood. Mm. But I mean, I think we've talked about this previously, you know, so much technical evolution and innovation comes out of war, porn, and advertising.
Exactly.
And maybe this is an example of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with everything you're saying there. In and of itself, it's slightly sort of so what, because the idea that, you know, a website that we're looking at is going to track where our eyes are looking in order to serve as ads is, yeah, it's slightly depressing, dystopian, however you want to put it. But there is, as you're saying, a wider point here about how we measure engagement online. The Guardian example is a really good one. And obviously from a cultural organization perspective, you know, they are typically organizations that are producing lots of content for all sorts of reasons. And it's always been quite tricky to measure the impact, especially of kind of text-based content. So these sorts of things are worth being aware of, I think. And yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Now, the last thing, the fourth thing we're going to look at, I've not actually managed to make work on my machine, but it's a project called Synthetic Memories, which is using AI to create images and video, as you've said, to reconstruct the memories of communities whose stories have historically been overlooked. Mm. And this feels interesting and potentially important and very applicable, obviously, in a museum context. But what is synthetic memories? Is it good? Is it interesting? If so, why?
Oh, good. It's a shame you couldn't get it to load. Yeah, so the reason for including this and why I think it's noteworthy is it has actually has a couple of different strands. So it's sort of partially a research project. So it's basically a group of kind of researchers, data analysts, creative technologists who are using AI with different communities around the world to build visual reconstructions, so photographs, videos of the past. You know, we've talked before, and you know, all over the place at the moment is the idea of using AI to create video. This is the same thing, but it's talking about producing, you know, stuff that looks old, basically. Why would you want to do that? Well, specifically, they are working with communities whose stories have historically been overlooked, underrepresented communities. And so, you know, it may be that those communities didn't have, you know, lots of photos of them taken and all that kind of stuff. So it's they're saying it's an opportunity to visualize realities that have never been captured on camera. And I think we hear a lot, read a lot, talk a lot about the negative side of AI, but this sort of thing is really interesting. The other strand of this research project is looking at how this kind of technology could be useful with early stage Alzheimer's patients. So thinking about how you can use AI to help people with their memories, to help capture their memories, you know, in the unfortunate circumstances where those memories are fading. So it's really just that sort of counterpoint to the narrative of AI is universally evil, I think.
Well, a good note to end on. Thanks for listening to this episode of Bytes. You can find all episodes of the podcast on our website at thedigital.works, where you can also find more information about our events and sign up to the newsletter. Our theme tune is Vienna Beat by Blue Dot Sessions. And last but not least, thanks to Mark Cotton for his editing support on this episode. See you again soon.